or any other research can account for the subjective fields, to speculations whether, for instance, silicon matter can ever produce consciousness, and so on, you know, the whole line of questions of the sort. The mystery of consciousness does not only result from the current inability to give competent and complete explanation to the what, how, and why questions concerning consciousness, but it already emerges at the very fundamental level of recognition that something physical can give rise to the psyche, that matter can cause mental phenomena at all. Maybe it would be appropriate just to try another sort of question, as my former professor Nelson Goodman proposed, rather than maybe instead of asking what is art, we should try to ask when is art? When is an object an art object, which maybe can solve then immediately the problem of Duchamp's, let's say, Pissoir or so. In such a way, we would treat, so we could ask, when is consciousness? In such a way, we would treat it, the consciousness, I mean, not a state, but as a process. And instead of the tendency to locate it within, we might find it more useful to look how it is realized in time and how forms of its meaning manifestations change, or how it evolved or evolves. And I think in some such way, that is what Max did in his recent article, which he kindly contributed to a collection of essays on consciousness that are edited and that is just now in print, trying to figure out at which point in the evolutionary history, or simply the question when, does consciousness actually arise. Most attempts to locate consciousness anyhow evoke erroneous conception. That it is something mysteriously closed within the depths of privacy, inaccessible to other minds and even to the self-observing mind. The standard theoretical equipment of the study of consciousness in the form of perspectives additionally emphasizes the double and irreducible nature of the subjective side of the mind, according to what is reportable from the subjective, that is, first-person perspective, is not accessible to the scientific third-person perspective. How justified is this in its insistence on the solipsist privacy of the qualitative conscious states, as contrasted to the so-called objectivist accounts of the externally observable manifestations of it, is one of the basic concerns of my presentation, though this might really sound heretic for some or for all, I don't know, but they're not sacred questions for me, and not any other sort that cannot be questioned. Let me proceed. I think at the beginning just briefly say something about the perspectival nature of consciousness. The characteristic feature of human beings that distinguishes them from other organisms is that they are minded creatures, living beings capable of consciousness and thought. That what characterizes human mind is further marked by uniqueness of a way the things in the world become objects of individual experience, and for which terms such as a perspective or a point of view are used. I quote Tim Crane, "What the daffodil lacks and minded creature has is a point of view on things, or a perspective. The minded creature is one for which things are a certain way. The way they are from the creature's perspective. A lump of rock has no such perspective. The daffodil has no such perspective." Unquote. This is very much in accord with John Searle's saying, I quote him, "My conscious experience, unlike the objects of experience, are always perspectival. They're always from a point of view. But the objects themselves have no point of view. Perspective and point of view are most obvious for vision, but of course they are features of our other sensory experiences as well." Unquote. The perspectival nature of consciousness is also what characterizes subjective experience. I quote further, "Subjectivity has the further consequence that all of my conscious forms of intentionality that give me information about the world independent of myself are always from a special point of view. The world itself has no point of view, but my access to the world through my conscious state is always perspectival, always from a point of view, unquote. And Tim Crane, when I talk of perspectives, I do not mean that perspective is a state of mind. It is meant to be a condition for being in the state of mind. Now, I elaborate on this, but I think I was reading in more maybe than there it is in this quotation. Anyhow, I'd rather proceed with my own words. Thus, a difference should be made, that's my opinion, between experience itself, according to which consciousness is perspectival, and they say first-person perspective on it. It can be also added that perspectival nature of consciousness, in the sense mentioned above, is not limited, whereas the first-person methodology, as a theoretical means, needs too many obstacles in order to be limitless. For one thing is to say that we have experiences, with which we are all born or get to shape them throughout life, and another thing is to claim that we have them from a particular perspective. We as conscious beings are not born with the first or any other perspective. It is something we get to know and learn as we mature as conscious persons on the one hand, and as we start to investigate conscious states theoretically and scientifically on the other hand, the way we do now these days. So much for the introductory part. Let me say something about the first-person perspective. What one commonly understands under the first-person perspective is the lived experience, also defined as phenomenal experience, or simply experience, as Chalmers would say, take it as it appears in consciousness from the point of view of the eye. In the philosophy of mind literature, it is also used as synonymous for subjectivity. More often than not, in order to stress the phenomenal character of experience, one grants the first person is all that what cannot be accessed from other perspectives, whereby insufficient attention has been paid to what the former easily really can convene, and in particular what it cannot. Somehow I'm just interested above all to critically try to see what it cannot, that is, what are limitations of the first person perspective, not because I do not belong directly to the clan, but just because I want to see it from a sun from a distance and eventually critical point of view. My concern in this presentation is basically twofold. On the one hand, I question the widespread assumption that suggests that the first-person perspective always necessarily reveals what lies, according to that view, inside or within, the consequence of which is the conception of the closed mind, which I criticize elsewhere. But this is for me a highly problematic stance, for I do not think that the first-person perspective is predestined to foremost get insight into our mysterious inwardness, some deep, hidden layers accessible only to the solipsist subject. On the other hand, I will share with you my trouble with the common understanding of the notion of within as reduced to isolated qualitative state, as distilled and abstracted, in the qualitative sense, abstract is from the lived experience. Even more, such raw fields, which I find terrible expression, are granted sort of independent existence, redness or sweetness or loudness. However, we have to realize that the qualitative states in such a pure form exist only in the heads of theorists, that's what I think, not in the heads of the subjects that theories are about. A widespread fallacy is manifested in the conviction or expectation that first-person modus has the capacity to almost automatically reveal what is going on personally and subpersonally in the conscious world of each of us. It is believed that whenever I switch to the perspective from the I point of view, a cognitive road is in a way open to unbiased subjectivity, though now after this experience here, I should revise this somewhat, or maybe also significantly, that is the idea that I had before, that in a way it is this very immediacy that can bring us to what can be considered as the consciously given.
in the blueness of the sea, the cry of the baby, the whiteness of the milk, the painfulness of the toothache, and so on. But the givenness of any sort is highly problematic, as we know from the philosophy of science and theory of knowledge. And it is not different in the study of consciousness either, I think. So let's question this givenness. For the questions arise as, how do we select the felt? What do we ignore and what do we promote as consciously dominant? And how do we weigh the many forms of appearances? For only a tiny fraction of the sense can or becomes experienced. As I read recently, they are to be trusted, but they are competent, the biologist Ehrlich from Stanford and Orthony, psychologist, saying in their book that we perceive actually 1 trillionth of possible sense data or sensible or inputs to which we are exposed. 1 trillionth. That's out of which, tiny fraction out of which we create what we believe to be an objective external world, internal too. Another theoretical means that favors unbounded susceptibility to subjectivity is that of the privileged access to the sphere of experience. However, it is frequently used to mean more than it usually can. After all, the privilege, according to me, means nothing more than it is me and not somebody else that is in possession of particular subjective states. Animals, I would guess, are privileged in the same way. They too have their consciousness, though they lack a perspective on what they are privileged about. The expectations of the first person on the part of theorists are very high, and often, I think, also mistaken. High and unrealistic expectations prove to be in regard to the privileged access, and mistaken the naive belief that a faithful first-person mirroring of experience, if it would be possible at all, would teach us anything. That the sort of duplicate to which we somehow, seems to me, aim at would actually be instructive for us if we could achieve anything like that. Yet the privilege can only mean that no else, as I said, can have access to our own subjectivity, but it does not allow for the conclusion that the privilege is limitless or that it discloses itself to us either automatically or without mediation. And an ideal first-person report, the one that would be capable of authentic and faithful representation of subjective fields, a sort of duplicate or replica, would actually have zero explanatory power. We actually wouldn't want to have any such duplicate, because what Virginia Woolf once said for reality, one of the damn things is enough, I think, is applicable for consciousness too. What should we do with this? Another thing, one of them thing is enough. Surely no one knows better than me how I subjective feel. But it does not follow that either I am the one, I'm the only one knowable of those fields, or that they can exist only within my first perspective. Here we meet a sort of paradox. Though the first-person perspective is most authentic, it is at the same time least explanatory telling. Indeed, it seems to me that we are ignorant of the fact that the directness does not speak for itself, that immediacy can be uninstructive, that closeness might blind us. No wonder then that what is considered to be most intimate elements of the mind turns out to be most difficult to account for. We are in general poor observers of our own internal processes, and that holds for qualitative states too. Had it been otherwise, the efforts of Rust and Claire and others would be much easier and simpler. The elements of the idea that we appear as strangers to ourselves, what is the title of Wilson's book, can be found already in Hume, as he remarks, I quote, "When I enter most intimately into what I call myself, I always stumble on some particular perception or other. I never can catch myself at any time without the perception, and never can observe anything but the perception, unquote. The illusiveness of the I as a self-reflecting subject is to be found also in Maurice Merleau-Ponty, as he says, the other can be evident to me because I am not transparent for myself, unquote. And thus the Harvey, recapitulating Merleau-Ponty's view on embodied self-awareness, puts in the following way. I'm never so close to myself, and also I'm always already a stranger to myself. Now, though I tend to disagree with Searle and his denial of the role of introspection, after reading Bernersch, I think one has to take this sort of investigation seriously. What he mentions in the quotation to come, but let's ignore it. It's something else that I want to show with it. So quote Searle once more. The very fact of subjectivity, which we were trying to observe, makes such an observation impossible. Why? Because where conscious subjectivity is concerned, there is no distinction between the observation and the thing observed, between the perception and the object perceived. However, this is not in accord with what I've just said, making this difference between having an experience and having it in a certain way, one of the three possible options. So further, the model of vision works on the presupposition that there is a distinction between the thing seen and the seeing of it. But for introspection, there is simply no way to make this separation. Any introspection I have of my own conscious state is itself that conscious state, unquote. Well, if it is so that the result of the first person methodology is qualitative state exclusively accessible to the mind that cannot be conceived other than closed, then the question emerges, is there a way out? We could of course imagine different possible answers to it, ranging from the negative one, basically on the irreducibility thesis, and the assumption that there are no equivalents to the qualitative states of consciousness, to those that allow that perspectives other than the first person may also prove to be potent in revealing the nature of subjectivity. What is implied in the first case is that there is no equivalent for authenticity of subjectivity and no possibility to replace it in any way. However, it does not exclude the logically existing opposite, according to which a reductive scientific formula of consciousness is in principle possible, but for now it lies completely in the future. It has become almost a common sense notion that each of us is authorized only for the first person perspective, and that only other person other than ourselves can act from or be act for the second or the third person perspective. If I'm not mistaken, since it's somehow some truism, some habit of thought at least. But please feel also free to interrupt me, though I'm reading this, is, you can stop me at any time and pose the questions or something is not clear. I think that much of confusion has been created just by literal attribution of the perspectives, first, second, third, to different persons, with further implication that what is accessible to one perspective remains alien to another. On the contrary, I believe one and the same cognitive subject can, and as a rule does, practice multiple perspectives. A cognitive person can switch from one to another form of reading, even between irreducible ones, as easily as one can perceptually zoom and adapt from one to another plane of perception, more distant or more to a closer. Though it is the very nature of subjectivity that it is shaped within the individual and particular point of view, what we often miss to point out is that it is neither unanimous nor fixed, unchanged or unalterable. In spite of the fact that it is limited, for instance, that my point of view can never acquire a perspective on Beth's experience, it is flexible and adaptive and allows each of us multiple accesses to the conscious world we experience. For that reason, I do not take perspectives and point of view as synonymous and claim that multiple perspectives are possible from a single point of view. No rebellion, no. Okay. The conscious.
Well, to be honest, I was confused when you said we couldn't have a perspective on another's experience at all.
Mm-hmm.
Where it seems like we can have a third person perspective on it.
Yeah, but okay, I'll come to this one. Just a little later. I think we can more clear. The conscious I can do a lot more than to conform to exclusively first-person modality. In other words, nothing prevents the self to be aware of own consciousness from perspectives other than the first one. And as you will see below, or later, the same can be said of the third-person point of view.
I understood what you said to begin with in a different way to the way that you're now unpacking it. Mm-hmm. So I thought what you were driving at is that you can shift your attention to different aspects of your conscious experience and have multiple perspectives on it. But the notion that you can have a third-person perspective on your actual conscious experience as such, I don't know what that means, so you have to explain.
I can internalize somebody else's third person perspective on my conscious states. That would be actually it.
I don't quite know what that means, but if you want to.
Okay.
When I report to the doctor and I say I have a pain.
I just wanted to give the same example.
Sorry.
Yeah. No. Sorry. It's fine.
You regard that as a third person perspective.
Because I'm putting it into third person terms.
Well, that doesn't change your perspective. It's just language.
Oh yeah. No.
Well,
no,
I think
you're exposed to not to me. I know maybe you are. This was actually my example. Okay. I have my pain, which is only mine, which is subjective, not subjective to anybody else that we know. This is phenomenal pain, but I am. By a third person, the specialist, the doctor, who has his objectivist third person perspective on my phenomenon and wants to know about it. Now, if in that very report his access in the third person perspective on my subjective state can change my experience, and it often does. It lingers or changes it, or by explanation it somehow modifies it, it places it in another context, it makes it in a way feel differently, if you want.
Certainly for clarification, what does make perfect sense to me is, and to all of us no doubt, is if I go to the doctor and I say, look, I've got a pain in my back, that what doesn't make sense to me is for him to say, well, now I can, let's have a look at your back. No, you haven't got a pain in your back. Your pain is up in your shoulder. But what does make sense to me is to say, I can see, that you've got a lump in your back. Or to take a different example, which is the one that you've just raised, where you might change your view about what the pain's about. I might say, doctor, I've got pain going down my left arm of a particular sort, and he, might be, pretty familiar with what that might actually mean, and say, well, let's just check your heart out, because that's a referred pain. Now, that doesn't alter the fact that I've got a pain going down my left arm, but, he, from his third-person perspective, can give a causal story about the likely causal antecedents for that pain that I experienced, but he still doesn't have a third-person perspective on the pain. I might also change my mind about the significance of the pain as a result of what he says.
What's he talking about?
But he
about
doesn't change the pain.
The doctor only has
He has third-person access. When he says here is an anesthetic for your pain, he's giving you an anesthetic for your pain.
The doctor doesn't have access to the experience. He can't have a third-person.
I don't need another doppelganger, as Germans would say, another twin that would have the same as me. I'm not looking for that, and that wouldn't either help my pain. Yeah, okay. Nor explanatory, have any explanatory power. So I'm not, and always have troubles with this sort of naive, if I'm not mistaken, actual belief that when we go, that somebody, if somebody only could feel the same as I in Michael, what could, then we will get to the point, then our study of consciousness would have the grail, so to say. I don't think this is the point. I don't think we need that the doppelganger, I don't think we need this perfect simulation. Just to make, maybe I'm misunderstanding.
No, I think we're probably cross purposes, because
I think this one has to be, this has to be somewhat clear, at least from my point of view.
It's just that the privacy of conscious experience doesn't usually refer to somebody, the business, they'll take this anesthetic and go away. That's got nothing to do with my pain, it's my pain and your pain.
I know, but he's talking about your pain, he's referring to your pain, he's thinking about your pain, it's just he's thinking about your pain from a third person point.
And the report is a third person.
Yeah, I mean.
Is he not talking about your pain? Is he not thinking
about
your pain?
He's talking about the report.
Yeah, but he's not talking about your report. He's talking about your pain.
He can't talk about the pain.
You might have given it.
He doesn't know about the pain.
Anyway, you found out that
this is the same object. I am because of my pain as a doctor, and he refers to my pain. Of course, he doesn't have my pain, and he shouldn't have. If he's not having a pain, and not he couldn't. I also. Okay, I shouldn't go there.
Just to clarify, I must talk about first and third person access to the same event, and that way of looking at it is fine.
Mm-hmm. I just think that we are somehow, for some reason, so sensitive from that we decide, we have too early or prematurely maybe, I don't know, decided ourselves when we are, so to say, pro first person perspective, that anything that has a smell or touch of the third person is destroying the authenticity of it. It is not. We have our pain, and nothing can replace, as I said, in this way, there is no duplicate for it. But if we want to get grip of the phenomenon, and if we have also this other's perspective, also referring to this, object, then it makes sense that this is not just mimicking what we feel. That this, in some way, is this clear?
Yeah, no,
this
depends on what you want to do, isn't it?
Okay. Okay, in some such way, we can also feel hurt, experiencing that we see somebody else suffering pain, and maybe this is good, just switch turn to the second person perspective. One of the implications of philosophy that affirms human cognition as embodied, embedded, enacted, and extended, as Jonas would say, is a conception of consciousness not localized within the head, but emerged in the body, bodily apparatus that actively participates in the events in the world, physical, social, cultural, and other. Such a consciousness is in a decisive way opened to the world of interpersonal relations. A powerful means of establishing bonds to other selves is empathy, in old terms Mitgefühl, that emerges as a result of imaginary as-if transposition in the mental world of other selves. In a more recent account, this is a sort of interpersonal bond made possible by Freud's psychological theory of mind on the one hand, or by mostly effective mimicking on the subpersonal, pre-reflective and pre-verbal level on the other hand. And here one can add also the whole story with mirror neurons, I think. If we start from the cognitive agent as embodied and embedded, and if we take empathy seriously, we are likely to avoid the problem of other minds in the radical form. Due to the mind's openness to the world, the first-person view is never a solipsist story told by an internalist self. Rather, the first-person experience is recognized within the second person, and I here quote Alan Thompson. If one were confined to one's own first-person point of view, such that one had absolutely no empathic openness to others, and hence to how one would be experienced by other, empathy as the experience of myself as being an other for you, one would be incapable of grasping that one's own body is a physical object equivalent to the other physical things one perceives. A physical object is something that can stand before one in perception, But the living body, from an exclusively first point, person point of view, cannot stand before one in this way. Okay, only through empathy, end of quotation, only through empathy can we recognize this other body as a living body, actually. It is in this empathic opening to others that gives ground for the revision of the conception of consciousness as completely private event, incapable, inaccessible, sorry, to other minds. Not only are we mentally open to the world, natural and human, of which we are part, but we get to learn about ourselves in otherness. Paradoxical, but in accord with the idea about the immediacy of the first-person perspective may lack a needed cognitive distance, we get to be aware of our own embodied conscious states in a way, and in a way learn about them just in the interaction with other living conscious beings, which makes us be both subjects and objects of own conscious activity. Such an emphatic relation is symmetrical, more mutual than one-sided, one-sidedly projected. I quote Evan Thompson once again. This sounds quite sophisticated and refined, whereby it is, I think it is part of really common everyday lived experience. I emphatically grasp your emphatic experience of me. As a result, I acquire a view of myself not simply as a physical thing, but as a physical thing emphatically grasped by you as a living being. In other words, I do not merely experience myself as a sentient being from within, nor grasp myself as also a physical thing in the world. I experience myself as recognizably sentient from without, that is, from your perspective, the perspective of another. In this way, one's sense of self-identity, even at the most fundamental level of embodied agency, is inseparable from recognition by another and from the ability to grasp that recognition emphatically. End of quote. Thus, empathy is not only a mode of experience others' a mental state, but also of grasping own experiences as empathically perceived by others. If there is a possibility of empathic mirroring of me in others and others in me, then there must be a way out of the imprisonment of the first-person perspective.
When you're saying emphatic, you mean empathic, right?
Empathic. Okay. Sorry for the... Yeah, I missed it. Thank you. Okay. Now to the third-person perspective.
Can I just catch that last sentence again? Because you seem to say there must be a way out of the first-person perspective. Is that right?
Yes.
That's
what I'm saying. Well, actually, repeating this sort of...
Yeah.
Also from the beginning. If the first perspective is something of the always this within here inside of her, is the way out through this second person perspective to make it be aware of it as a part of our world. It is quite habitual in the contemporary literature on the consciousness to contrast the first person methodology with the third person perspective in a way that hardly leaves a possibility of affiliation and even less of exchange, of course. First-person subjectivist data are almost commonly defined just in opposition to the objectivist third-person reports, and I'm not questioning this in a way. I question something else I'm going to come to. The way these methodologies are then conceptualized from the start implies that qualitative experience of the former cannot ever be adequately captured by the scientific means of an investigation of the latter, behavior, brain processes, environmental interaction, computational models, and so on. The hard problem of consciousness makes the gap between two unbridgeable and paves the path to the irreducibility. Yet there are also those who claim that a thoroughly empirical account of consciousness is possible. But let me try at least at this moment for these current purposes to distance myself from these extreme or radical oppositions and look for the domain where eventually this exclusiveness does not hold or is not applicable, and I find it in the language. Maybe in no other domain does the formative power of language come more to expression than in the field of consciousness. The very verbal labeling of colors, the music characterization of sounds, analogous narrative of taste sensations, kinesthetic training of movement, and so on, all witness that the high-level cognitive processes as expressed in language shape the low-level sensations. Meanings make the impact all the way down to the sensory experience, so that it is difficult to draw the strict dividing line between the former and the latter. Verbal interventions and narratives interfere on the very fundamental level of experience. For instance, I think a simple onomatopoeia can do. I played with this and then discovered how differently I cannot say conceptualize, even not verbalize, but put into sounds, or human sounds, or human language. Let's say the cock in the morning, that is obviously for Croatian, is heard like kukuriku. That was not kukuriku. How is it in Slovenia?
Kikiriki.
Kikiriki, you're like Germans. You have always been like Germans. You've always been like that. This is another...
French is very important, actually. Kukuriku.
Kukuriku, that.
It's very important because the symbol of France is precisely...
cock.
A cock.
Yes.
Yeah. But the most weird thing is in English. Kukududu. How can you hear that way? Well, I'm glad you implied that the way we shape it into sounds also shape our auditive perception of the animal. So I think it's never in that sense also intact. You can take also another example, but it's not. I think it's sufficient for the moment. It's very much actually in accord. No, first I want to say this. It is difficult, if not impossible, to hear a pure auditory sensation. And the way we hear sounds as sounds of something tells us that the cognitive shapes the experiential, cognitive in the broadest sense of the word. And Heidegger, in Being and Time, famously said, we never hear pure sounds. We always hear the cracking of the cars, and what was his example? We cannot hear just the vocal shapes, so to say, of the spoken language of the speech. We always hear the language.
Franco, what about just a pure tone? Is that not?
I wouldn't say. If I would now, for instance, počeo govoriti hrvatski, koji ne razumije, većina vas ne razumije, osim jednog Slovenca i jednog špijona ovdje, onda... Okay, I started to speak Croatian, which is alien totally for most of you. But even in the case of foreign language, you do not perceive it, I'm sure, as amorphous sounds. You perceive it as a language that is not familiar to you. Okay, even if I would hear a Chinese or any other exotic language, I would guess I would perceive it in a way knowing that this is a language, somebody's language of which I have no idea. And I think it would be also quite difficult for me just to concentrate on the written here on the page and see only graphic signs without immediately reading it. I think this is a fair analogy.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it is.
That's pure tone. Well, even that's not a pure tone.
No, this is not pure tone. This is your...
If it was a sine wave, it would be a pure tone.
This is human. This is whistling. This is... I immediately know that this is human whistling as compared to somebody else.
You find it hard, that's the point you make.
You know, yeah.
So you're saying that even if you don't know what a sound is, that we will automatically attempt to fit it into something familiar, something like that?
Some conceptual structure.
Yes.
I'll give you an example. They're doing some road work across the road from where I live.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know they were doing that. And I woke up in the morning and I heard what sounded like a camel. Now, I know we don't have camels.
You see, you heard the story.
I heard a sound that reminded me of a camel, but I know we don't have camels.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew it wasn't a camel, but I hadn't a clue what it was.
So it can shift, but you heard it as a camel.
No, I heard a sound that reminded me of the sound a camel would make.
Didn't hear it as a camel.
But you didn't hear it, it's completely amorphous.
That's what
you're saying, not telling you anything.
So that's what I'm asking.
Not telling
any time we hear a sound, we will automatically, you're saying that we will automatically associate it with something familiar. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I would say that we would, like in the world, like in any perception, we don't have sense perception plus interpretation. Basically, that is what I want to say.
Uh-huh.
We don't have in any experiential moment, let's say any form of perception, you don't have sense perception plus interpretation. We have only one. Could we agree on this?
Galahad says you don't see the car, you see your car.
I think this is very shiftable. Yeah. This is flexible. This is very shifted. Yeah, and probably the, as Sel would say, with the car, and then my dog can probably recognize car, but he cannot recognize this Volkswagen made in this, and so on. And more basically, just as I said, I think it's related directly to this. It is almost epistemological truism in a way, at least for me. We don't have this isolated sense data. No matter what Moore thought of that, I think I never was able to see his white patch. He showed Endelope, I think, or his students, he said, this is only white patch. I think it is impossible to see that white patch if that was Endelope. And so don't have this sense that plus interpretation, okay? This is one and the same process. We see something as that what it is for us experientially. And that's just to finish this, I think this was a camel. This showed it like maybe to in a way analogous to that. You may hear that or know that what you hear is a sound produced by musical instrument, but not know exactly which one. Which happens for that? You can also confuse oboe for flute or bassoon for trumpet, or and it happens. It requires very good ear to discern the violin and brace and so on. But you hear it always in some way, the same way almost, if it is not too big an analogical leap when we talk about appearances and something. So we hear it always hear as something. This is also sort of. I'll be right with you. Sorry, I was more oriented. Ladies first.
Now I'm embarrassed because you just beat me. Okay. But it's simply that I was at just lunchtime. I had a little walk, and there was a sound that I could not place. I didn't know. It's a sound I've never heard before, and it took a few moments to think. That, what are the possibilities? And it was the trees, these very, very tall trees that were rubbing together.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard, the only way I knew it was those was to look up and to actually see them rubbing with the synchronized sound. And then I knew what that sound was. But I heard the sound. I didn't think of the sound as.
Right.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's something. But that was the process. Yeah, this is the though I should be able also to answer this. I don't believe that this is. You certainly were able to eliminate many of the potential.
Yes, but not at the time. That was not subsequent.
Not an animal. Not. Any sort of machine. Bird. Not so lots of then was excluded.
It as part of the natural. And surroundings that you're in. But people, when they hear sounds that they really cannot account for, they start getting frightened.
I didn't hear it as a natural sound in these surroundings because it didn't seem to me like a sound I could place in this one. It just was a sound.
Right.
And then I had to think what it might be.
I wouldn't even exclude that in that sense. However, it is not pure in the sense that it is also not pure. It is just that we don't have it in our repertoire, cognitive repertoire, so to say. So it cannot sound as anything.
What about, say, I mean, is it, why is it so important to have the thesis, to hold the thesis in an absolutely exceptionalist way? Why can't you say that, you know, for the vast majority of cases, we, when we hear sounds, we hear them as, you know, something we interpret them. And why is it important for there to be no exceptions for this?
Because I think they are simply very rarely exceptions.
Well, there are exceptions. Yeah.
You say rarely?
Why does it matter to your thesis to make this point? That's for, because we all grant that we normally see things as things. And we simply take issue with that.
I think it would be very tough, almost impossible, for the neural system to check any sense data. If we function that way, that the brain actually goes with the most of the whole theory about the picturing, about this we know now, this is not mimicking. Just one is completely wrong, because the way the brain constructs out of this limited data that it receives here in the dark caveat, which is also not anymore optical, let's say if we are measuring visual perception, that it leaves the optical and a lot more anymore during the path of the nerve converts into chemical and physical reactions. So it has to be separate. It's a long story. Of course, I'm just making this quick, but I think it is important just to have an idea that there is no way, as you know nowadays, in the brain we can picture the reality out there. Okay, there is no point of conversion, there is no homunculus that could see anything. We even, for the very simple perception, for the visual perception, have four different centers for the color, for size, for motion, for in different spaces. So even that has brain somehow, in some miraculous, this is really mysterious, miraculous ways, composed together in order that we have, that I have the chair as it is, as a compact object. So if it is now, just to not to make this all to low deviation from where I started, the brain projects in a way and works in such a way that it creates the most, according to the available data in the moment, actually creates the most probable version of what is going on around there. So it's brain's, the reality is brain's best bet. About what we have around. In this context, I would place also this. Brain cannot check, it would be too much of a burden, it would crash. It would really start from every element and construct impossible. Let me just finish, because I think it completes this, this question of sound, of pureness, and how. So it, in a way, always goes with the meaning. With the meaning of what it means, or from the
right.
Okay, I'll stop rusting.
So let me give you an example of the kind that maybe you haven't thought about, because most people don't think about it. But this is a beef of a guy who has a female roommate, and they've been engaging in a conversation. And at the moment of the beef, he had diverted his attention from the conversation to the basketball game. He was watching the basketball game on TV. That was sort of the primary part of his conversation. But the girl continued to chatter on. And at the moment of the beep, he reported he was watching the game, and he could hear this sound over there that, when on reflection, he could say was his girlfriend's or his roommate's voice. But at the moment of the beep, it was just the sound to him, with no meaning, no words, no understanding, no comprehension, no nothing. Just a sound coming in that wasn't the main portion of his attention, because he was watching the rest of it. No comprehension of the word, what she was saying, but not there.
So it sounded like she was speaking Croatian.
Could have been speaking Croatian.
It was like his voice.
Could have been singing Bach.
Was it? But it was it? Was it?
Anna Magdalena.
At the moment, he described it. It was sort of like hearing the musicality of the voice.
So
not
it's a musical instrument.
No, don't get carried away by the words.
See, it's the musicality of the voice.
No, don't get carried away by the words. The guy's got to describe the situation. And he's trying to say he doesn't have put verbal meaning on it, and he hasn't put voice meaning on it, so it's sort of like a musical instrument. Which doesn't mean that it is a musical instrument. It means that I'm at a loss to describe this. And I'm not trying to say that there's meaning there, but it's not much meaning.
It's the only thing we have. So we have it, to put it somehow in the words. Okay, well, I have also to cut it radically because I don't want to be much shorter.
How are we?
It's four, just after four.
Yeah,
that's okay.
I think in spite of that, this couple of examples still did not sort of convince me. Also, what I wonder is what would be this, what sort of cognitive achievement would it be, I think, if we would finally come to the naked, say in this case, auditory data, a sound, and be happy that this is the, so to say, this is what we were looking for all the time. That sort of philosophical strategy I somehow don't understand. I could even allow that there are sounds which we couldn't, that the brain cannot decipher and receive them. Though maybe emotionally, I think there is always place for emotion as something unpleasant, maybe for as something disturbing, as it may be in the case of that. No? It has also this sort of interpretation. Only I don't know what this is the purpose of the philosophical strategy, so to say, to come to the pureness of it. Any sense or experiential quality.
Well, while you're thinking it through, just keep in mind that many subjects report that they're doing three or four or five different, fundamentally different things all at the same time. And I'm pretty sure that that's what the way their experience is. So whatever heuristic you're going to have for the brain processor or whatever, for some people you got to let them be doing four or five asynchronous things and three or four different sense modalities, all something.
No, I don't have problem with simultaneity. I don't know how this simultaneity came into this story about the meaningfulness or interpretability of sensory data. I think this is possible that it goes in parallel, and it is possible, and it is also possible that they are meaningful to the subject. I got the confirmation. We are all looking for the support for our theories, you know. So I was happy to hear from Semir Zeki for the last year in Prashod in his institute to actually realize that I think his newest book will be also about it. That a brain works more on this conceptual basis. It conceptualizes. It makes pattern on this on this level. It is, as he said, impossible that brain picks up all the elements, and it wouldn't be able, obviously, to make sense of what we are, of which we are surrounded. And what we call, it's a big word, world.
Doesn't he?
It's a world.
Yeah, he does.
Well,
he's famous, of course, for his theory of microconsciousness.
Yeah.
And the notion that for instance, there might be an elemental experience of red or movement, and that's literally a kind of microconsciousness, as evidenced by neurological syndromes, where, for instance, you can have movement without shape or colour, without form, and so on, while accepting that in the normal integrated state, mm-hmm. you know, you do get the higher order stuff.
Yeah.
But just maybe so to go past this, I mean, you're kind of saying, well, you seem to be saying, look, why bother for the pure experience, given that it might be cognitively penetrated? that let's say you're right, you might, let's say you were actually right about this, then I would have thought the phenomenologist project would be to be looking at the way it's cognitively penetrated as well as the, you know, this is just an empirical fact.
Yes.
Either
yes.
It is or it isn't.
Very
and you,
yeah,
you, you
okay.
Still wind up with an interest in phenomenology.
Yeah. I would agree that this is now extending or enriching my point, and it is good because otherwise some people get really the impression that I somehow really totally away from the phenomenological account, what is not the case, only maybe it's
can
not
add,
possible all to put into one paper. Yeah.
Can I just add a quick reference then, if you're going to look at some of this? Adam Zeman, chapter 5, he talks of wonderful examples of a kinotoxia and a chromatoxia, where people can they lose the colour actually the better one is a kinotoxia, where they can't see movement, but they can see the object. It's a super example, it's chapter 5.
Just quickly,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Zeman's actually. Well, no, different people.
Yeah. In this context, well, I have sort of a problem, of course, with the qualia, the way it is standardly presented. As I mentioned at the beginning, this redness of a strawberry, this. Loudness or the sound of a cello, many like or flute or any other instrument. Well, as already said, I think this is maybe a poor example of what these authors want to show or to prove, because they say already this is sound of a cello. Recognize it as such. So it is by no means pure in that sense. Okay. And the redness of the strawberries is also, I think, for ordinary people, and we are talking about a lived experience or lived stories, then the strawberries, the redness is also a sign or symptom of ripeness, of etability days also. So this date, and if I notice a redness on your face, I doubt I will see just as redness, it is rather the sign of either excitement or shame or whatever. And something that says, okay, I didn't elaborate this, I tend to elaborate something like cultured qualia, because I think it is very, very artificial, requires a very artificial process of extrapolation of everything from the experience of an object to bring it to the level of qualia only. Artificial and, how would I say, brutally imposed is distillation. Actually, then...
It's artificial in a very specific, in the sense of art. That is, artists tend to do this all the time. They have to, well, they don't have to, but they often do, try to not see it as a railroad track going off into the distance, but rather two lines pointing towards each other, or just not see it as an apple,
yeah,
correcting a patch of red, and
correcting the nature. But with art, it is all more
artificial.
Yeah, the art is not only about the artificial, so it is much, much more there. And I don't believe for sure that in art we have this. That this is a good analogy for this sort of pure transfer. That I believe even less in art, because it has to pass through, you know, through the medium, through hands and eyes and mind of the artist. I mean, just to provide what is sort of out there is a highly complex thing to do. And well, that is the whole chapter, big chapter, which is an interesting one for us.
It's not that uncommon, but uncommonly known, that there are many people, much of the time actually, who would look at the strawberry and see the redness of the strawberry and not see the strawberry. That they get somehow drawn to the redness, not because of its ripeness, not because of anything else, but because they're drawn to the particular sensory qualia of the redness, and that's what grasps them. And I'm not denying that they may also see the shape of the strawberry. But what's occupying the center of their awareness is the redness. And in my study,
awareness
is the redness.
But awareness. So they're aware of pure of the color alone. Okay, that I'm checking whether I've heard this.
Yes.
Aware
yes.
of
and
color
and
alone without.
In the best study that I've got, which is not a great study but a pretty good study, it happens that kind of phenomenon happens about a quarter of the time in randomly selected themes. Some people, like actually many philosophers, don't ever have that kind of experience. some people have that experience almost all the time, and when you average it together, you get about a quarter more of your time.
But then I could pose you the question you posed me a moment ago: why is it so important for you to have this pure, to have this sort of? Why is that important in contrast to this? Let's say content dependent or with meaning layered experiences of objects.
I have no idea. I'm just wondering what the phenomenon is as best I can figure it out.
Yeah, but that is the answer. You know, because a lot of the discussion and a lot of the presentation is about what the phenomena are really like. And if he says, "I study this."
Mm.
That's what they tell me they're like. So he's being empirical. He's following the empirical method. And we're sitting here arguing, basically. And in the end, you know, you've got to listen to him.
I've learned.
You get my point. I'm
yeah, no, I got it also. Don't have to look at it. I got it also. I've learned a lot. I not only about. I really did. Not only about these specific cases, I think that the lesson, the epistemological lesson, if you want, is the powerful one. You know, we are all here, we're exposed at the same moment, sharing the same contextual situation, exposed, so to say, to the same inputs, and came with so different experiential stories or worlds. Personal world, so to say, fractions of personal world that we could expand. So this is a very, very powerful lesson. It was also for me, you know. Usually, you know, not contested to be placed. The input is important, that it is what it reflects, you know, and all the whole story. Now suddenly we have, it is not. We are all exposed to the same inputs all the time. We share the same situation. We eventually only have different angles in which we sit, but everything else is identical for all of us. And then you open this.
But the lesson might instead be that you can have all that identical context relatively and still have very different experiences, rather than the conclusion you seem to be pushing, which is, look how different our reports are, even though it's it's pretty probable that we're all having very similar experiences. It could be the other way too. They really were having.
Otherwise, I think these reports wouldn't differ. these reports wouldn't differ that much. However, I don't know, in the longer process, maybe.
One last thing about the sensory awareness phenomenon. Most people who have sensory awareness frequently don't know that they have sensory awareness. And it takes rather a long time, like 2 or 3 days worth of sampling, for them to finally recognize, well, this is what's going on with them. Because apparently the conversation about that has been bred out of them at a fairly young age.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not surprising that most people who analyze this thing don't really recognize the existence of this phenomenon.
Have you ever, sorry to put the question, but it comes to me, have you ever thought of that whether maybe for this great part of people it is also a matter of verbal skill that they were not able to put in a more refined terms, or your method still you think was precise enough, you know, to get the sort of answer that is for you unambiguous on this.
Am I clear? I'm quite sure that it isn't a matter of lack of verbal skill.
Or whether
we absolutely understand each other is clearly an issue. But these people would start out by saying, well, I saw the straw very well, that isn't exactly right. And then later on they would say, well, I was really paying attention to the redness of the strawberry. And then the next time in my iterative procedure, they would be able to say, well, I was really paying attention to the coolness of the breeze and not really the sound of the wind or whatever. and with some practice, then they will be able to say that I was paying attention to a particularly sensory aspect. It took me a long time in my history to recognize that that's what I was trying to say to women. So I'm sure it's not just a deficit of the ability to describe.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I think I'm going to stop somewhere here. I plan lots more things, but I think I spare you.
It wouldn't be fair. We'd be losing. May I say, Max, I wasn't laughing at your remark because I agree with you entirely. It was Ross's face when you said, eventually, we'll have to take some notice of it.
Yeah, but Ross knows that I'm on his side on this one. You know, so.
Oh, I know.
Okay.
It's just simply putting it that way.
Yeah, and this one is important.
Okay, let me finish maybe this passage. I have obviously what is good, what is excellent. Best thing that can happen is that one can learn something new. You know, so I'm always eager. I love this what I'm doing just because I never have the feeling I'm mastering anything because I like the process of learning. So
I have with me some interviews that have people describing sensory awareness if you like.
Mm-hmm, yeah, for sure.
May I listen to this too? Would that be possible?
Sure.
Okay. Now, to summarize somehow my view and skip some parts, unlike in the philosophical literature on consciousness, where perspectives are mostly strictly kept apart, whereby insistence on their irreducibility is made pronounced, in the mental worlds of us as conscious beings, all the perspectives coexist, as is my view, and are permanently practiced in our daily lives. The splits the theories have created are ignored by the conscious subjects they are investigating. To say this does not mean that there is a common denominator for different modalities. Indeed, the perspectives cannot be reduced to one another, and they cannot be experienced simultaneously, but they can be related. Each is authentic in its own terms, first person and the third person, second person. But each is a description of a conscious mode open to other possible descriptions. Irreducibility, after all, does not imply either incommensurability or incomparability. I think the parallel with Kuhnian paradigms is not out of place here, so I take the perspectives, perspective parallel somehow his paradigms. A critical remark that paradigms, though incommensurable, are not, for that matter, incomparable, holds also for perspectives. No matter how different they are, they can be mutually related, compared, and eventually complemented. And with that, I'd like to finish, and I thank you for your attention.
Been very enjoyable.
Thank you.
coincidentally, we thought of knowing the other through the look that Sartre talks about. You know yourself.
Yeah.
Through the gaze,
exactly,
of the other.
Yeah.
And I was taking this down and show this.
Yeah.
And at the same time, Michelle was going for this. So.
Yeah.
That's one of the problems with relocating to here, because everybody keeps looking here.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so I tend to use others' notions of where I am for my own idea of where I am. So
yes.
If everybody looked here, then maybe I would start being able to think of myself as here.
Well, funny for the rest of the day, you haven't.
Right, yes.
That's a good point, though, isn't it?
Because
that's where you think of yourself, because people look you in the eye.
I tried to make that point earlier when we did the exercise.
Oh.
Okay.
But you see, Jack, I'm still wearing this. For me, this process is not over. And to put in an Armstrongian term, who said on the moon that a small step for a man, great for the humanity, maybe this is a small step, you know, just put or distance in the geography of the body from here to here, but a great leap in the consciousness and awareness of our conscious states. Indeed, what everyone mentioned, it is really a whole new, with this shift, it is a whole new perspective that is changing from, say, maybe dominantly visual, what we are, and verbal to this powerful instrument that we have right here, not certainly without reason, biological and other, certainly to maybe breathing, mm-hmm. you know, of which we are not otherwise conscious of that sort of alienation with the world and embodiment in such a new way. So this was also very helpful.
Just a small point on the last bit. I've done quite a lot on what you seem to be saying, which is the point of where you say we take all these perspectives for granted in everyday life, for example. The notion of mixed perspective explanations it actually seemed quite useful to me. In working out mind, how to make sense of mind-body causal interactions. So it's a little bit of a shift, but one of the big puzzles, you know, of mind-body problems is how do we understand the causal interactions of consciousness and the brain? One first step that you can take is to say, well, just to take one example of a causal interaction, take an input stimulus, it produces stimulation of the brain and so on, which results in an experience. And then, of course, the mysterious bit of that from the point of view of third-person science is just the last bit. You know, how does the experience arise from, you know, what seemed to be the final bit in the observable third-person story, which is the correlate of that experience in neural terms. But basically what we just take for granted and we don't necessarily always acknowledge is that in order to get that account, what we have to do is kind of get an account which is third-person perspective, all the way from the input stimulus to the neural correlates in the brain, and we switch to the subject's first-person perspective. And so it combines how things look from an external observer's point of view with how it looks from a first-person point of view, and that gives you the complete causal story, at least in the ordinary everyday sense of the word. There's still puzzles, of course, that you have to then sort out.
No,
it's the ordinary cause. I'm just talking about the way we normally talk.
Not the way I normally talk.
Well, if I say, you know, this stimulus and brain states caused my experience, you know, then I'm mixing perspectives. That's all I'm saying for the moment. I'm not really grappling with all the puzzles.
But you're not going to agree with that, right? Because you think we can have third-person perspectives on experience. So when we talk about experience, we're not necessarily adopting the first-person perspective. Is that right?
Let me just get back to my this example with which I do have somewhat a problem, because we do have a big, now I suddenly will be more critical, also skeptical of the third person perspective, knowing not in principle as I showed in the paper, but now actually in the sense, as you said, we have everything here and this causes, well, from the very competent neuroscientists, we hear nowadays that actually the only thing they can check is whether neurons, there's usually a bunch of them, neurons fire or not.
Sure.
Yeah, and even, there's nothing I would say, we even don't know what it means when they fire. So it is very little what they can convene on this causality. Actually, we do learn quite a bit from this side, but on the other hand, when we listen to them carefully, at least a good deal of them first-rank neuroscientists, they cannot, they have no access to the mental state.
No,
you can only measure neuroactivity, and so this transition from the first that you mentioned to this experiential one is a really huge one. There's where the mystery really.
No, I agree with you, but I'm just saying that this business of switching perspectives.
Yeah. Okay.
It is common, and that you have to notice that somebody has switched perspectives.
Right. Now, this
you know,
is
I haven't addressed the problem. You know, I've just said, look.
Okay.
Because you was.
I agree.
Look, we use these perspectives all
this
the time,
like,
as if it isn't a problem, and I was just agreeing with you. Really.
This is like duck rabbit picture already. You know, you could switch both readings and not simultaneously. There's no way to reduce them to one bit of thought, and then we can compare them and make use of them in the best possible way.
Okay. Just, I was thinking that many of the Buddhist practices that are meant to unlearn the strata of interpretation that you associate to certain perceptions. And there are beautiful stories about how to learn to hear a sound. And learning to hear a sound is precisely learning not to conceptualize it.
To learn to forget everything we have learned.
Yeah.
No, it is amazing. I guess this is also interesting too. And also in that sense, we are not given in any sense. So it is obviously possible also to relearn. But I think this requires the way we are, the way we function and get already, are born already pretty much pre-patterned. It must be really quite a task to be able to forget or ignore this humaneness.
It's quite a task, it may.
And after all, it is, though I guess this must be some special sort of experience, it's yet the question, why would we like to be less than this bird in Susan's video? Why should we want to be less than a worm, or whereby we are so impressed when such a simple animal can do such fine things? Why should we really want to be less than that?
Okay, Ron, go ahead.
Just a suggestion. If you want, it would maybe strengthen. I didn't hear a lot of your. I mean, obviously, you had to skip a lot of your papers, so I don't know whether you'd address this, but might strengthen your argument what you're saying is you're placing yourself in a debate that I'm not sure you have engaged with, which is the debate between conceptualists and people who believe that there can be non-conceptual aspects to experience. And so there are arguments that the non-conceptualists have given, like for why there can be aspects of experience that aren't conceptualized. And so you could strengthen your position if you could look at their arguments and show whether you're wrong. And because I'm a non-conceptualist, so I think there are arguments for thinking there are aspects of experience that aren't conceptualized.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be because I'm using a technical term of concept. You might, when we talk about it enough, you might say, oh, right, as long as you agree that the world is presented as being somewhere or another, that's all I wanted to say. So whether that means it's concepts or proto-concepts or whatever, I don't care. Just as long as you admit that you can't experience the world without experiencing it as being some way.
Yeah.
In which case, I would agree. If you weakened it to that, then I would agree with you. You do experience it as being one way or the other. But I think this term concept, I use it in a technical sense, and so I would say that's far too sophisticated for a lot of our experiences. So.
Okay, thank you. I think it's rather as a comment rather than as a question.